This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show this morning, some of the first communications out of Tonga have started to come through. First up, you'll hear from the World Health Organization's rep on the ground in Tonga with an update on the recovery efforts that are happening there. And there are calls for the disaster relief efforts to be Tongan-led.
Unsolicited donations have caused more problems for countries than they have helped.
Also coming up, the Solomon Islands has confirmed its first community transmission of COVID-19. Dr. Belin Kafoa will join me in 10 minutes to chat about that situation. First, though, the Tongan government is understood to be weighing up the risks and benefits of allowing international assistance on the ground as the post-tsunami recovery operation continues. While ships from New Zealand and Australia are expected to arrive by tomorrow with a helicopter preparing to drop aid from the ground, the COVID-free kingdom is keen to ensure that the nation stays that way. The man in charge of the country liaison office for the World Health Organization in Tonga, Dr. Yutaro Satoya, says the government's perspective of much of the recovery response could be done domestically, but it will come at a cost. So speaking to Talia Olatia via satellite phone, Dr. Satoya stresses that ensuring Tonga has access to emergency relief funding is a priority.
The major issue for many of the Tongans is the ashes. So the heavy asphalt, they find ashes everywhere. So it's gray everywhere. So people are up and running trying to clean their houses with, you know, some bombs. But still, there's a lot of ashes on the roof. And because of the cleaning, and it has been very dry 3-4 days, ashes everywhere, and it's actually causing an issue with air pollution. Mm-hmm. So WHO is requesting to wear masks when they're outside.
And, yeah, in terms of those cleanup efforts, the ash, like, how thick is it as it has settled? And is it easy to kind of just wash it away, or does it just end up somewhere down the street?
So it was like about 1 or 2 centimetres thick when we woke up the next day. So it was like the first time it snowed in Tonga, great snow. But, yes, so we are asking people to use water to clean the ashes. But of course, some people are just doing it with, a mop to the street. So when the car goes to the street, there's a lot of small particles throw up in the air. So we're trying to ask them to use the water as much as possible. And we are really hoping that the rain will come to wash these ashes away.
Does it have a smell? Like, lots of people have concerned that, you know, sulfur, that smell of rotten eggs. Is this what the ash smells like?
Oh, not actually. Actually, we were able to smell the sulfur before the eruption, but after this, the ashes doesn't smell. There's no bad smell.
Well, that's at least.
Or maybe you're used to that.
Yeah, that's a relief, at least.
Yeah. I think that is not nice.
Yeah. And can we talk about the damaged properties? Because we've seen satellite images from Australia and New Zealand, their surveillance that they have been doing. In terms of damage to properties, how is that looking?
So after the eruption, after 10 or 15 minutes, the tsunami came to the coastal area of Tonga Tapu, the main island of Tonga. And there's a lot of damage, especially at the coastal area, especially in the western side of Tonga. So I heard that more than 100 households were damaged in Tonga Tapu. Around 50 completely damaged. We lost communication with the other islands, so we could call within Tonga Tapu and Ewa, nearby island Ewa, but we lost communication with Hapai and Vavau Island. And because of volcano, it's between Tonga Tapu and Hapai, we were a bit worried. We were very worried about Hapai Islands because those are the small islands with the low rising thing. So the government sent us to explore, and they found that many of the islands, small islands, completely washed away. But still, the best of there was only 3 deaths despite the damage.
There were reports that there was a distress signal that was detected in that group of islands. And we've seen reports that Mungo saw 15-metre tsunami waves and all the houses there were destroyed. I believe that there are 50 people who live on Mungo Island. Is there any more information about the welfare of the people, especially in Mungo, Namuka and Fonuafua?
I understand that all the people in Mungo and Fonoi is evacuated. I don't know actually where, maybe Namuka, maybe to Hawaii Island, I'm not sure where, but I heard they are evacuated.
Oh, okay.
In Namuka, people are still there, yes, the team went there to do the initial assessment and also to provide initial support. The government is taking care, providing with shelter and food and water.
We saw yesterday that the Tongan government was able to send out a press release confirming that there were 3 official deaths, but they were also saying that there were injuries as well. Do we know if there have been any more deaths? And when we're talking about injuries, do we have any more specifics on what kind of injuries were sustained?
As of today, there's still the total number of deaths is 3, 1 in Tongatapu and 2 from the Hawaii Islands. In terms of injury, there's no formal update, a formal number, so I don't know how many, but I understand there's not many injured as well.
Okay, good.
Not many.
In the damage assessments that are being done, for the people in Tonga right now, what are the key priorities?
For the people, majority of the people, for the affected area, of course, they have, you know, they lost their house, so that's the priority. But majority of people here in Tongatapu is the air quality. So the ashes is an issue, and the drinking water as well. So we're requesting them to drink bottled water or tap water, but some doesn't have access. So we ask them to try to avoid the contaminated water in many of the filters that drink those water. So what is the rain to wash away the ashes? But from the government perspective, many of the response could be done domestically. So, but of course, it comes with a cost. So probably the most important thing is that Tonga has access to emergency relief fund or something so that our government can provide support to the people in need.
And in terms of international efforts, because I know lots of countries, Australia and New Zealand obviously included, are looking, standing by and are ready to assist. So in terms of international assistance, where do you think that that would be best placed?
Mainly New Zealand, Australia, providing, you know, shipments to Tonga. So there's flight and ships planned for come to Tonga for humanitarian aid. So those items like, you know, masks, PPEs, you know, dignity kits, humanitarian and support kits, those kind of things is appreciated. But as I said earlier, I think the most wanted is funding so that governments can provide support.
And in terms of international assistance, again, I know that members of the Tongan diaspora community have been concerned that places like Australia with high COVID cases, sending people over, obviously Tonga is COVID-free and would want to keep it that way. Is there messaging in Tonga about the potential risk of COVID with international assistance? Is that something people are worried about?
Yes, I think, yes, the people are worried and also the government is discussing the risk and benefit. So we would like to remain COVID-free, especially the Omicron variant. So we are very cautious in putting people in. So the government is discussing if there's a need to have international human support, you know, to come here, or we can provide more support domestically. So I think they're in discussion, and if we decide to have people to come to Tonga, I think there will be still strict procedures we need to follow, including quarantine.
And we know that the volcano is still active. Is there any on-the-ground reports of, you know, is there a possibility of further eruptions? Is there anything on the ground that is just obviously not getting out to the rest of the world about the status of the volcano?
For that, I don't have any data. But, of course, the government doesn't know if it's beginning or the end. So, yes, we are aware that we may have more can follow. But we don't have any result of the actual activity right now.
Yeah, no.
But there is a Tonga Metro, there's a department looking into that.
Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to add to the interview?
Not really, but I just want to point out the strong resilience of Tongan people. You know, I also observed after the cyclone, but, they're... Tonga people are very positive and they want to react to this crisis. So people are up and running, with strong community ties, we're helping each other to clean. And it's good to see that people are, trying to do something to fight against this crisis. So this is remarkable. And
yeah.
Also the government is, discussing very nice to how to support the people. So I think there's a good energy here. So I think that's a good thing.
Mm. And in terms of just the confidence in the government, because I know it's obviously a very new parliament, they were only signed in last Thursday. What has the confidence been like in the Tongan government in terms of dealing with this crisis?
I think they're trying their best. I think they're confident they can do what they can do. And of course, if it's not enough, they're happy to provide, ask for support to the development partners. So we have been attending development partners meetings. So we have a good network of foreign diplomats here in Tonga on the ground. So I think that we have a good team.
Dr. Yutaro Satoya, who heads up the WHO's Country Liaison Office in Tonga, and he was speaking to Talia Olatia. Now, switching gears to some COVID-19 news in the region, Solomon Islands and Kiribati have recorded their first cases of COVID-19 community transmission. A 60-hour lockdown is in place in Honiara as medical authorities attempt to contain that COVID-19 outbreak some 9 days after an infected person travelled by boat from Ontong Java to the capital. Authorities are urging anyone who travelled on the MV Aqua 9 days ago to get tested immediately, but there's concerns that it's too late to contain the virus. While over in Kiribati, the first commercial flight in almost 2 years has reportedly brought 40 COVID-19 cases into the Pacific Island nation, which had been virtually untouched by the virus. And now a curfew has also been put in place. Joining me to consider what this means right now for the region is the Pacific Community's Director of Public Health, Dr. Berlin Kafoa. Good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Dr. Berlin, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manessa Sogavare confirmed that community transmission happened 9 days ago. It took 9 days for him to tell the people of Solomon Islands that a positive case had arrived in the country. Has Solomon Islands dropped the ball here?
I think generally our SPC as a technical agency has been working with the countries to tell them you assume that you will get it and prepare accordingly. Given the highly transmissible latest variant of Omicron, that's our stance. Eh? That somehow or the other, yes, we can protect the borders as much as we can, but the assumption is you will get it at some stage and prepare accordingly. And then our role is to assist the country prepare for that. Solomon's has one of the things that Solomon has to deal with is increase its vaccination rates so that deal with the hesitation, the misinformation, and yes, all of us can try and get vaccines there. But as I said earlier, it's the assumption that at some stage, whether it's Omicron or another variant, we have to prepare the population accordingly.
On vaccinations, Solomon Islands has a vaccination rate of just above 20%. What are the first immediate things that the country is going to need to do to try and bolster that vaccination rate?
One is to get enough vaccines in country, and then the second is to have extra efforts in trying to convince their own population to be able to take up vaccination. I know there's a hesitancy. I know they deal with misinformation, and our role is to assist the government try and overcome them. But getting vaccinations on the ground and then convincing their own people to take it up.
It's been 2 years since the start of the pandemic, and you're saying the SPC has been working with countries around the region to prepare for situations like this. Aside from the vaccination rates in Solomon Islands, is the country otherwise prepared to deal with this?
Solomons and Kiribati and some of the Pacific Island countries have fragile health systems. So when we have, and you also see developed countries struggle with the virus when it reaches big numbers. So the honest answer is any health system will struggle if the population gets heavily infected. So I think our role is to ensure that we work with the countries to protect their borders. And I wanted to share that with, for example, the Kiribati flight, even though there was testing, I think there's a key message in when your test is negative 24 hours before that flight, the message needs to be strengthened. It doesn't mean that it gives you free leeway to go and ignore the public health measures. It's that key period that anybody going back in country, especially in the first flight back, is to make sure that in the 24 hours they don't go out and get infected before they get onto the plane and then head back home taking the infection with them. So I think in helping countries, again, we work thanks to the Australian government, New Zealand government, France and EU. One of the key things that we worked is to strengthen their capacity to test. And now, again, with these recent outbreaks, their laboratory capacity has really increased to be able to test and detect the virus.
And now with the Solomon Islands and Kiribati's testing capacities, are they currently relying on PCR tests or the rapid antigen tests?
They're currently relying on a bit of both. We know that they have PCR capabilities now. And increasingly, not only in those two countries, but around the world, people are using rapid antigen tests. And so our stance is, yes, they can use both as long as they have a capability of testing people who come out into their countries and to have good isolation protocols in place. And so if, for example, in Kiribati, people come in and therefore tested positive, the training and support work has been to make sure that they have good quarantine protocols in place.
And you're talking there about before needing there in that 24-hour period, even if you've tested negative, to make sure that you're not, you know, moving about the community and potentially picking it up anyway before you get on a flight back to Seoul or back to Kiribati. Do you think that there needs to be any extra testing measures, like using a rapid antigen test, you know, 1 hour before the flight to make sure that you really are securing who is getting on the flight and coming into the country?
If it's possible and you have the resources, yes, we would recommend that. Again, it's just making sure that you get on the plane absolutely confident that it's negative. Mm-hmm. And we would advocate for that if you have the resources to do it. If you don't, then the message has to be reinforced within the 24 hours. And then when they do land in country, have a good isolation protocol before they are... go out to meet their families in the community.
And finally, Dr. Berlin, now that there is that community transmission in Seoul and Kiribati as well, you know, obviously pushing for higher vaccination rates is very important. But what can people be doing now? What can they be taking on board to make sure that they are limiting, I guess, that exposure potentially to COVID-19?
As you said earlier, both countries have implemented curfew hours. I think it's important for them to follow the public health measures set out by the individual countries, avoid public gatherings, wear the mask whenever they go out, and all the usual public health measures. So I think vaccination rate going up plus good public health measures can help curb the virus, and of course strengthening their laboratory testing so that the country has an objective measure of where they're at in terms of infection rates.
Dr. Berlin Kapoa, thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you for the opportunity. Minaka.
That was Pacific Communities Director of Public Health, Dr. Berlin Kapoa, speaking to me there. Time now for all the headlines from around the region, and I'm joined by Richard Ewart. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Jordan.
We're starting off in Papua New Guinea, where the government there seems to be warming to the idea of Australia's Telstra taking over Digicel Pacific because there's been a high-powered meeting taking place in Port Moresby.
Yeah, it's taken the Merape government a little while to get behind the deal after some previous complaints about lack of consultation, amongst other things, but all seems well now, with the Prime Minister, James Merape, and his Treasurer, Ian Ling Stuckey, offering assurances to Telstra's Chief Executive, Andy Penn, Head of International Business, Oliver Camplin-Warner, and the Australian High Commissioner, John Philp, the five of them getting together at Waigani. Telstra announced its proposition, or proposed, I should say, acquisition of Digicel Pacific in October of last year. It's worth around $1.6 billion. That's about 5 billion kina. That's a lot of kina. Mr. Ling Stuckey did say that with regards to Digicel Pacific's PNG business, statutory approvals are still being sought. These from the Independent Consumer and Competition Commission, the National Information and Communications Technology Authority, and also the Bank of PNG, all prior to a final settlement. But they're heading that way, so that's clearly good news too. Mr. Ling Stuckey went on to say that given the Australian government's commitment to provide a financing package for the acquisition through the Export Finance Australia initiative, he would further update his counterpart, Australia's Treasurer, Josh Frydenberger, during Mr. Ling Stuckey's visit to Australia next month, as well as seeking to progress negotiations with Telstra CEO Andy Penn as well. So it appears they're all mates now and all on the same page.
It's all plodding along. It's all happening.
Yeah. Expensive plod, though, isn't it? $1.6 billion.
Very expensive plod. And when it all, I guess, comes together, we'll find out how people in PNG are feeling about it and what it means for them.
Well, they might get cheaper connections, but don't hold your breath.
Big questions. Yes. Now, let's head over to Marshall Islands. They've had a recent COVID scare, and now comes news that critical air services have been suspended.
Yeah, Marshall Islands still clinging to its COVID-free status, although there was that rumpus with the USA a couple of weeks back when a bunch of service personnel broke the protocols, and was it about 9 of them, I think, were COVID positive, but they managed to keep them in quarantine. So at the moment, there's no community transmission in Marshall Islands. So that's one thing. But that situation might stay the same because United Airlines has called a halt on its flights in and out of the Marshall's capital, Majuro, apparently because of safety issues. As a result, Giff Johnson, editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, says the city is effectively cut off from the outside world. It appears United are not happy about the state of the airport terminal roof. And really, you can't blame them because this has been at high risk of collapse apparently for the last 2 years based on an engineering evaluation that goes back 2 years, but nothing seems to have been done to fix the problem. United is the only international carrier servicing Marshall Islands, and it will still fly to Kwajalein, but not into Majuro. The scheduled Wednesday and Thursday United Island Hopper flights that were due to go from Majuro to Honolulu and Guam, they were cancelled, and future flights are now suspended for an indefinite period. So it's tough enough getting around at the moment as it is, but even harder now for those living in Majuro. In better news, Asia Pacific Airlines mail cargo and tuna export flights were also in question at one point, but now it appears that the regular scheduled flight due tomorrow, in fact, will go ahead. So cargo still being shifted, but people going nowhere.
Yeah, and that is definitely 2 years with a faulty roof. But I guess, like, the pandemic, and if you've had your borders closed and you don't want to bring people from the inside, maybe that's why.
Difficult to say. I mean, we've had a few airport issues around the Pacific over the years, haven't we? I mean, Vanuatu's dragged on for a long, long time. And sometimes it's just a case of cash.
And I guess, you know, it is something that probably needs to be a focus because as we're seeing with Tonga at the moment, you need to get airlines in if natural disasters happen. You've got people shoveling ash off of the runway that was delayed. And, you know, when critical times are about, you do need those resources and infrastructure there.
Well, it's the quickest way, that's for sure. Although, of course, Tonga weighing up, as we heard earlier, the issue, do they want people coming in or not?
True. I mean,
it's extraordinary, isn't it? And normally you'd take all the help you can get and try and in a measured kind of way. But now, do we want people coming in from overseas? Do we want COVID-19 on top of all the problems we've got? I mean, gee, who'd be a politician.
It's a very, very challenging situation at the moment. Let's go over to some sports news now. Cricket Vanuatu have parted company with their high-performance manager less than a third of the way through his three-year contract.
Yeah, this is really rather unfortunate. I mean, this is the Aussie who played international cricket for Ireland, Jeremy Brait. He was the man at the helm. I remember speaking to him at the time when he got the job, and he was, I think, still in isolation or unable to get into Vanuatu. But he got there in the end, and by all accounts, he was doing a very good job. And Cricket Vanuatu's CEO, Tim Cutler, says Brait's departure is a huge blow. The reasons for his decision to resign based partly around his personal circumstances and also travel complications linked to the pandemic. So no surprise there, I guess. It's a real shame, though, for Cricket Vanuatu because Tim Cutler was saying that Brait has had a huge impact, and despite a lack of international competition in recent times, he had the contracted players in the best condition of their lives, the CEO says, and every player's individual game had improved. It was also Brait's decision to integrate Vanuatu's professional women players with the men to create a blended group, creating what's believed to be the only professional international mixed cricket squad in the world. I must admit, I've not come across that happening before. And the idea of them training together, and I dare say playing practice matches together and all that, that would... Yeah, I mean, I can see that working well in the Pacific. I'm not sure how it would go here in Australia, to be honest. But, Anyway, it's a bit of a pioneering venture. But unfortunately, Jeremy Brait will leave that as his legacy, I suppose. And assistant men's team coach Eddie Mansali, he'll take over at least for the next few months. But, yeah, that's tough on Vanuatu because they're the next cab off the rank for cricket in the Pacific after PNG.
The pandemic just continuing to wreak havoc everywhere. Now, staying on sports news, though, briefly some news of a Pacific athlete qualifying for the Winter Olympics in Beijing.
Yeah, this is Nathan Crampton. Excuse me, the voice is a bit dodgy this morning. He's the skeleton racer. Oh, that means racing headfirst on a sled down an ice track. Kind of cool if you can do it.
And you're not terrified of it, because that would be very scary.
that would worry me, I must admit. But anyway, he's going to be carrying the flag of American Samoa into the arena at the opening of the Games next month after making it through for qualification for his event. He sent me a message overnight in an email. In fact, short and to the point, it said, yes, all is set. I qualified and was confirmed yesterday.
Amazing. So
that's all you need, isn't it? Short and to the point. So well done to him. He's been in China for a while, having to stick to strict COVID regulations, very, very strict regulations in China, because he was taking part in test events to make sure the track was okay and he had to qualify as well. So all successful. 4 years ago, it was Peter Tafatafua, you may remember, the Tongan, who's busy raising funds for his home country at the moment. He competed in cross-country skiing in South Korea. Didn't do all that well, as we didn't expect, but it didn't come last.
Amazing. And, which is pretty amazing, to be honest.
It is pretty amazing for a man who was previously into Taekwondo. And now Nathan will be there in China for the Pacific this time. I think he'll be the only athlete there from the Pacific. On his day, based on his past form, he's raced for the USA in the past. He was in the top 10 in the world. This guy, you know, if he hits his straps, he could win a medal for American Samoa. How good would that be?
Pretty impressive. Yeah. That's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, he's an author and he's a model and he's a track athlete and he's a Winter Olympian and yeah.
He can do it all.
I know. I hate him.
I know. Very jealous. And one to watch clearly when the Winter Olympics do eventually roll around. Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. Richard Hewitt?
He's actually a very, very friendly guy.
Oh, wonderful. So it makes it even worse, doesn't it? He's so nice and so talented.
Yes.
Richard Hewitt, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
No worries, John.
Now time to take a look at the weather, starting off in Samoa in the capital Apia. The morning is starting off with some rain and that will develop into a mostly cloudy day with a high of 33 degrees. Over in Solomon Islands, Honiara, thunderstorms today and showers will continue into the afternoon, a top of 29 degrees. A touch warmer over in Vanuatu, where the capital Port Vila will have sun showers this morning and heavier rain expected in the evening and a high of 30 degrees. Brief showers as well in Suva, Fiji this morning, then mainly cloudy the afternoon, a top of 31 degrees. In Port Moresby, a top of 29 degrees with thunderstorms and rainfall expected throughout the day. And in Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa, it's a fine day and a sunny day with a top of 29 degrees.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halitau.
World Rugby have released nominations for Players of the Year.
Yeah, it's controversial because there's no All Blacks players in there.
This is a little bit shocking to me. Not a little bit, hugely shocking to me.
What's the old saying? The champion team, not a team of champions.
Maybe that it was intentional. Maybe they're like, no, we want to be recognised as a unit as opposed to an individual effort. Because, hashtag full credit to the boys.
Yeah.
Can You Be More Pacific? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. Now, taking you over to Tonga once again, because a clearer picture of what is happening on the ground is starting to emerge, with more pictures and communications coming out of the kingdom. And the latest surveillance images from the New Zealand Defence Force suggest that there's very few structures left standing on the resort island of Atata. Amongst the biggest questions being asked from the international community is, how can we help? Both Australia and New Zealand are now ramping up their assistance efforts, while France has expressed its solidarity with the Tongan people and says that it stands ready to respond to the country's most pressing needs through the FRANS mechanism. Donations and funds for Tonga are also being raised at a community level, with the New Zealand Warriors and the Melbourne Storm announcing they'll dedicate their upcoming trial match to the people of Tonga and raising funds for those affected by the weekend's natural disaster. While the outpouring of all this generosity is greatly appreciated, as Talia Olatia reports, there is a growing feeling that the disaster relief effort needs to be Tongan-led.
Charles, you there? I'm on the set form from the Neva.
This is the voicemail. Selesi Mataeli left for his daughter Joanne in Melbourne. He continues in Tongan.
I'm calling to let you know we are okay. I tried sending an email, but I'll check again later.
For Joanne, who usually talks to her dad every day, it's the voice she's been waiting to hear.
So all I heard was, Joe, it's Dad. And I started bursting into tears. And, you know, I was like, oh, my goodness. Because, you know, what's funny is that yesterday my auntie from the States had actually reached out to one of her contacts in Tonga who had spoken to my mum, and she was just relaying messages back. But for me, that wasn't enough. I don't know if you call that being selfish, but I wanted to hear directly from them and hear their voices through the phone. So, last night all I did was I prayed. I was on the phone with my support group. And then this morning when that voicemail came through, I said, you know what, like, our God is definitely real. And yeah, just hearing my dad's voice, I was such a mess. But it was good.
Joanne says not knowing if her family in Tonga was safe was taking an emotional and physical toll on her.
I've probably been like living on 4 hours sleep since Saturday. So the last time I heard from my dad was 6:30 p.m. Tonga time on Saturday, literally just right before the blackout happened. And, you know, I probably have been calling out to them for about over 1,000 times, just trying to get through. So my dad is asthmatic. So all I was thinking about was, you know, did he take his puffer with him? Is he okay? And then just thinking about my mum as well, like, you know, are they fine? Are they safe? Are they all together?
For many Tongans outside of the kingdom, it's still an anxious wait trying to make contact with their loved ones, with Southern Cross Cable's chief technical officer, Dean Viverka, saying it could take until early to mid-February to repair the damaged undersea cable.
And we suspect that the breakage is caused by some sort of underwater landslide or slippage that has then broken the cable. But this one is obviously significant because of the magnitude of an underwater volcano eruption. So it could take a lot longer than normal repairs.
With communications down, it's made assessments of the damage in Tonga more difficult. Aotearoa New Zealand's Foreign Minister, Nanaia Mahuta, says satellite images show significant damage along the western coast of the main island Tongatapu, as well as in the outer islands.
In the outer islands, in terms of Mango and also Nineveh, significant damage there. And I understand the Tongan government are making preparations to evacuate a couple of the outer islands, Mango and Whanui.
Australia's HMAS Adelaide departed Brisbane with emergency supplies for Tonga, with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison saying the country is providing support.
We've always been prepared to provide support to our Pacific family whenever they've needed it. And that's exactly what we're doing in Tonga. They need us now, and they're getting our help.
The Australian government has already pledged $1 million to help with the initial humanitarian effort, an amount that has been criticised on social media for not being enough. However, development consultant Ashley Betteridge says the number usually increases once more is known.
I understand why people might think that an amount is too low, and it's great to see so many people expressing their thoughts and care for Tonga and wanting to see Australia and New Zealand and other donors launching a substantive response to this crisis. But it is quite standard in humanitarian responses for bilateral donors like Australia to announce an initial amount, which goes towards those really essential human needs like food, water, medical supplies, tents and so on. And then once the needs have been assessed and the damage has been assessed and there's been able to be substantive meetings and discussions with the country government and they've been able to make requests to Australia or other donors, then we usually see a more substantial recovery package announced.
And that willingness to help is also being felt at a community level, with many asking what they can give or send to help the people in Tonga. On Monday, the Speaker of Tonga's Legislative Assembly, Lord Fatafehi Fakafanua, said more details of Tonga's official disaster relief fund will be announced to ensure that the help offered reaches those in need. Often, after a major disaster in the Pacific, there can be an influx of unrequested donated goods, and those good intentions can have negative impacts. Ashley Betteridge again.
It's so good to see people wanting to help and contribute, but it is something that we need to do carefully and thoughtfully, as there's definitely been cases in disasters in the past where unsolicited donations have caused more problems for countries than they have helped. For example, during the Indian Ocean tsunami, countries' airports and supply chains were clogged with donations of things that weren't really the most important things needed right now.
Back in Melbourne and compelled by the need to help and to be of service, Joanne Mataele is coming to grips with the Tonga she remembers and the Tonga now being shown via satellite images.
Being here in Australia, I just felt so helpless. And yes, just sad to see Tonga like that. I don't think I'll ever wrap it through my head that Tonga looks like this now. I'm pretty much still living in all these throwback pictures and videos that I still have of home. And I refuse to believe that, you know, we are covered in ashes. But this is the reality that, you know, that I need to put into my mind, is that when we go back home and what our people are currently going through are all these pictures that we're getting via satellite. And, you know, just, yeah, it's really devastating.
But at least she has her voicemail message from her dad, and she hopes by telling her story that other Tongans abroad might also find comfort in knowing that the connections are still there.
I'm really happy to share it out to my Pacific people, especially to my Tongan people, to give them some sort of comfort in knowing that if I can get contact from my dad, I'm pretty sure everyone else will be able to get contact from their loved ones and their people. It's just a matter of time and when they'll be able to get in contact.
Charles, you there? I'm on the set form from the Neva. Yeah, the battles are almost over there.
The voicemail, Selesi Mataele in Tonga, left for his daughter, Joanne Mataele. Ending that report there from Talia Olatia.
ABC Radio Australia.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk.
I kind of came to realize that my hair is one of those avenues of expression, and I have the freedom to express myself through my hair, through my body. It's one of those things that belongs to me, that I have control of and can do with as I please.
I'll be interviewing incredible guests.
Early cervical cancer is completely asymptomatic, and we can be walking around feeling completely fine and not know that we've got cervical cancer.
And discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
These cultural expectations and practices really contribute to women, especially we are vulnerable to polygamy.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk, Friday at 3:30 p.m. PNG time
on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell here with you on Pacific Beat on this Thursday morning. And it's January 20th, which means that it's that time of year when families across the Pacific are getting ready to send their kids back to school. Amid all the excitement, it can also be a stressful time for parents tasked with buying uniforms, textbooks, and stationery for the new year. But did you know that there's another key ingredient for a good education? It's one that dietetics expert Dr. Sarah Burkhart believes can be very easily forgotten, and that is health food. Marion Farr has been speaking to Dr. Burkhart, who says that the school children in the Pacific are exposed to a triple threat of nutrition-related issues.
We have, I guess, what we call the triple burden of malnutrition in the region. So quite often obesity and overweight is talked about a lot and some of the implications of those on children. But what's also important to recognise is that in the same region, we have people who are undernourished. So, you know, rates of stunting and wasting are quite high in some regions, and we have quite high rates in some groups of micronutrient deficiency. So those issues are a real problem, particularly in growing children, because you need nutrients to develop and grow. And if you're not getting those, then that's quite a big problem.
And how can these issues be addressed in the Pacific? What changes do you think need to happen?
That's a really great question. I think we need to be thinking about multi-sectorial approaches. It's not just, for example, people working in education who are responsible for teaching children good, healthy habits. It's not just the responsibility of people working in health. Everyone across that food system, whether it's the farmers, the fishermen, the people who are involved in food processing, the people who are selling food, right down to the consumers, the schools, and the food environments that people choose their food from, that we need to work together to make a more supportive environment for people making their food choice.
And through your research, what have you found out about the availability of food and the types of food that are available in schools across the Pacific?
So that varies depending on the schools, and very much depends on the location, because it really relies on the availability of food in that location. So schools which are based more in urban areas, we know tend to have, but not always, much more accessibility to highly processed foods that are often imported. So those are the foods which we would be saying, you know, we really should be consuming less of them because they don't have a lot of nutrient value. But they can sometimes make up quite a significant proportion of someone's daily intake. So those children who are going to school in urban areas are probably more likely to see and have access to those highly processed foods. What we find in the rural areas is there's often more reliance on locally produced food, which is fantastic. That's great, not just for the children, but also the families and communities who are producing that food and supplying it to schools. But what we have seen recently is that even in some of those rural areas, we're now starting to see some of those ultra-processed and highly processed foods becoming available for children.
Can you give us some examples of ultra-processed and, highly processed foods?
Really, when we look at ultra-processed foods, quite simply, it's as far from the original product as you can go with processing. So a lot of things that if you walk into a store, they'll be the things that can sit on the shelf for a very long time because they've been processed and they've been packaged.
Mm-hmm. Now, some Pacific countries have implemented healthy food programs in school canteens and tuck shops. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about these success stories in the Pacific?
There are some wonderful initiatives going on in the Pacific, and I think that's also one of the aims of the network, is to highlight some of those and help people learn from what other countries are doing. So, for example, in Fiji, the National Food and Nutrition Centre works very closely with the Ministry of Education, and they have policy and standards in place, and that supports children and people who are working within canteens as well, providing food to schools to ensure that that food is actually meeting a particular standard and that the children are getting those more healthy foods. There's also some great examples. For example, up in Palau, they have a really wonderful school feeding program there. So They support thousands of children through healthy meals on a daily basis. And where possible, they really focus on the integration of local food within those menus.
And could those programs become a model that might be used in other Pacific countries?
Definitely. So while every country is different in terms of location and sometimes the ability to grow their own food, there's definitely aspects of these things that are working in different countries that can be taken to another one.
Now we know that it's coming up to the start of a new school year in the Pacific. What advice do you have for parents across the region as they prepare to send their children back to school for the new year?
It's a balance, really, because I think there can be a lot of pressure sometimes to feel that you are providing your child with the right food. And I think sometimes we also have to recognise that we just need to do our best with what we can do. But I think if possible, it's talking to your children about healthy eating. If you're not sure how to talk to them about healthy eating, there's wonderful resources available to help you do that and to explain some of the reasons for why it's good to be eating healthy. But it's also around trying to provide them with options that they can choose from that are healthy too, and making that option the easiest option. So if you are, for example, going to put food in the lunchbox, try and think about what are some of the local foods, what are some of the things that are less processed, they're less high, or they've got lower fat, salt and sugar content. They're going to keep the kids fuller for longer. Otherwise, if you're sending them with some money, for example, to buy food, talk to them about what might be a more appropriate food to be purchasing on the way to school or from the school canteen as well. We know that what children eat can have a direct impact on their learning too. So sometimes it helps to explain to them that, you know, you'll find learning a little bit easier. You might be able to concentrate a little bit better through the day, if you are choosing those foods which are a little bit healthier as well.
That's Dr. Sarah Burkhardt from the University of the Sunshine Coast speaking to reporter Marion Farr. Taking us to the end of the program, thank you so very much for your company today. I will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but right now you're headed towards 5 minutes of the news.